Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
What's good, internet? It is Monday, February 12th, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 134, coming to you not live, but absolutely in charge. From Brooklyn, New York, Lobby One. You already know what it is. It's late in the day. We're recording way later than we normally do. So I have not had a sandwich yet. I was supposed to get a banh mi, but it has not shown up yet, which means I have no energy. So I'm trying to just invent some energy. I'm trying to find extra energy inside of me to bring forward into the world. But I could use some more. I could use some more from you, Danielle Riendo.
Yeah.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I hear it's your birthday soon.
It's my birthday tomorrow.
Shout outs to Danielle. Shout outs to birthdays.
Really
also
excited.
Joining us, Rob
Zachney.
Rob's
got his hands up.
Rob's hands are up. Do you have something to say, Rob? I'm calling on you,
Mr. Zachney. No, I'm just sending you my energy.
Oh, yep. Thank you. Yep. Sending your energy
it's
for
really
the spirit,
nice.
Rob.
There's also, like, some really good God rays going on
there
with
are.
The background here.
Rob
yeah,
Zachney
good.
Coming to us live from Far Cry 2. the rays are piercing through that giant palm in the background.
Oh, my God. It's a giant fucking palm. Oh, my God. So, the thing is, like, it isn't supposed to be this big, but, like, there was an IKEA, and they just had a palm tree that was supposed to be a tiny little decorative palm tree. But if you just, like, leave one in an IKEA and nobody ever buys it, it turns into a bigger and bigger palm tree. And my partner went to the IKEA and, like, Charlie Brown fell in love with this fucking palm tree. And so
wait,
now
what's
I have,
Charlie Brown fell in love?
Like the sad little Christmas tree.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
suddenly
okay.
She was like, I have to bring this thing home and care for it. So now there's like 7 feet of palm tree in my living room, which
it's
a questionable choice.
It is unique. I agree, Patrick. What's your favorite unique plant?
I'm gonna be honest. I haven't given that one a whole lot of thought.
I'm putting you on the spot.
I'm not big on plants one way or the other. I mean,
not Patrick Klepek, not big on plants.
I think flowers are kind of bullshit, and you got to put a lot of work into them, and they die in a week. So, like, just get fake ones. Like, fake candles. We have fake candles in our house. Mm. You know what? Can't fucking tell the difference between fake candles and real candles. It just doesn't smell. And you know what? All I do is click a button. Yo, there's candles. Let there be candles.
Wait.
None of that, like, wax
what
bullshit.
What are you talking about?
Fake candles, you just light them up. It's like the fake torch things that they have in restaurants.
Yeah, that's the part where I feel I could tell the difference, actually, between a fake and a real candle.
I like the ones that make noise.
Those are fun.
Do you know the ones I'm talking
yeah.
about? Those noisemaker candles? They got,
no?
like, wooden wicks, and so they crackle and pop.
They have, like, yeah, it's a nice energy.
It's a nice energy. I need one.
That sounds
like
a good way to light my house on fire.
Me too.
That's why I don't own a house.
I like these things that crackle and pop as I burn them.
Welcome to Waypoint, your number one stop for arson. Speaking of things that...
Uh-huh. No, yeah, keep going.
I'm going to find this. I'm going to find this segue.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Crackle?
Speaking of things that crackle and pop, you know what else crackles and pops? The sound of a golf ball
yeah.
hitting the bottom of a tin cup at like a mini golf
crackle
course.
And pop
are we talking
right
about
there?
Tin cup?
We're talking about the movie Tin Cup.
Classic from the late 90s.
Classic
great movie.
Kevin Costner.
Welcome to our Tin Cup spoiler cast. Danielle, you were about to say right before we started that you had gone mini golfing and that there was a story involved. And I was like, wait, you have to tell me this, but only in front of a microphone.
Yes, absolutely. I went to the Sleep No More of mini golf this weekend right here in New York City. In Red Hook in Brooklyn next
wow.
to the IKEA. We're talking about IKEA, you know, we're wrapping it all in.
Mm-hmm.
It is an immersive sim mini golf that has a storyline. If you buy $5 for the story tokens, you get to go into this little curtain area where a really fake pirate guy tells you about how his ship, the Paper Towel, yes, it's called the Paper
That's
Towel,
a bad name
and there's
for
a bounty
a ship.
Joke in it too, and he keeps making
oh,
bounty jokes.
I got
it's
you.
Amazing.
But
tells
like
you.
An actor?
It's like like a video screen with a bad actor on it.
Not even a real actor? They couldn't
no,
even get
it's not
a real,
even
fake
a real
pirate?
Actor. No, it's amazing.
Do you
it's
have to
so
go
good.
Is the curtained area every hole?
Like, is there, like, you go to a hole and then there's a booth, like a story booth that you can walk into and, like...
There's a story booth at the beginning, uh-huh. and that's where it sets the scene.
What's
there's
the scene? An immersive, can you spoil
so
us?
You're on a ship. It's called...
The paper towel.
And yeah. it's sunk, and there's treasure. It's all you need to know. And then there's also, like, an arch nemesis who's, like, this cartoon lady.
Ooh.
A little bit Carmen Sandiego there, but okay. it's her name's not Carmen Sandiego. She is on a subway called the Footlong. Yeah. There's like corporate jokes all over this thing. It's amazing.
People say that games try too hard to put story into them. It turns out mini golf is actually the one we should have been concerned about all along. Where is Ian Bogost writing this fucking Atlantic essay about mini golf narrative storytelling?
Mini golf is better without characters.
I can
characters.
Only assume he just hasn't gone here yet because this clearly is like his next 10
Come on, Atlantic.
Columns.
Figure it out.
Atlantic, get on this. Now, that's the first part. That's the first little room.
The
and then there are like 6 or 7 story bits that if you bought the $5 in story tokens, certain things like light up. And then there's a little sequence in a submarine where you push a bunch of buttons and the submarine lady talks. Yes. Yes.
Okay. So is the rest of the golf course like tied into this pirate theme? Like
sorta.
Okay. Because the question I had is if I didn't
Good.
Spend
That's
the five
best
extra
answer.
Bucks to go into these narrative booths, am I still going to feel like, oh, this is an interesting, bizarrely pirate-themed mini golf, like, park?
Yeah, it goes through several themes. There's, like, an underwater area that's very tied in, and then you start going to, like, a gold mine area where the story token just makes a bomb explode. That's it. There's no, like, dialogue.
Gold?
There's no gold. There's
Why
just
did
a
the bomb.
Bomb
go off?
There's just a bomb. I don't
so it's
know.
It's like experimental narrative.
Like I said, this is the sleep no more.
You're
there's
just
a lot
like
of layers.
A season pass for this mini golf experience.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
So you get different things. Sometimes you get a story expansion, and sometimes you get some costume DLC, and sometimes a bomb blows up.
Sometimes a bomb blows
Real
up.
Real actual feature.
Yeah.
There's a sign in the sort of gold mine area. There is a sign that tells you that the, like, boots and, you know, minor accessories that are littering the area.
Sorry, do you mean minor accessories? Like non-major?
M-I-N-E-R.
Okay, but not, oh, so people who
like
mine.
People who mine,
okay,
minor.
Got you, minor.
Boots and pickaxes and such are real accessories that have been recycled because, and it's called Shipwrecked Golf. I'll just tell you what it is so you can go there if you want. Shipwrecked Mini Golf. Shipwrecked Mini Golf cares and recycles. There is a sign that says Shipwrecked Mini Golf cares
and
recycles.
Well, that's I'm glad that someone does.
It's really
recycled
good.
From what?
Recycled from
real
miners. It's really fun.
I can get a Groupon, it looks like.
Yeah, I think we did that. And you get pizza with the Groupon, so.
Oh, like traditional pirate pizza.
A pirate pizza. It wasn't bad.
Sorry, I was playing there.
Yeah, I was. What are you doing over there?
The place, it's amazing.
Oh yeah, play the trailer. Boost
yeah,
that volume.
Yeah, there it is. I wonder if the guy is in there, the actor, the pirate actor.
Is there video?
Oh, and that lady is the, she's the villain. She's the villainess of the
she
piece.
She lives in Williamsburg.
Of course
I know
she
her.
Does.
She works in this building.
Of course she does.
That's Natalie. Don't you go to school with
I
her?
I think I dated this girl. Like, clearly.
Were you there on a date with this woman from
Definitely.
The subway that was trying to steal?
I beat her really badly at mini golf. That's
wow.
what happened.
So that's what you've been playing.
That's what I've been doing.
American Laser Games presents mini golf.
God.
If only.
Order food and drinks at our front counter. Sailing can make you hungry. Enjoy some food from our menu or grab a quick snack to, quote, whet your appetite before
yes!
you begin your adventure.
There's also an 80s arcade, which is set up in such
theme.
A fashion. In theme. There are, like, boxes mm-hmm. strewn about and mm-hmm. straw, which I guess is a very piratey thing to put around your 80s arcade games to make it look piratey. I love this place.
Using their
I mean, that's the... Is it good?
This is actually... They have, like, a mission statement.
They do.
Welcome to Shipwrecked Miniature Golf, a theatrical indoor 18-hole miniature golf experience like no other. Shipwrecked is a family-owned and operated business created by two best friends who met in college and moved to New York City to pursue careers in theater. After starting their own families, they saw a need for a unique and interactive business in Brooklyn. Using
just two friends who were fed up with the price of theater tickets and mini golf.
This is
and they started their own narrative mini golf company.
Using their expertise from working on Broadway, they moved forward on an idea they had tossed around for the past 16 years, and Shipwrecked was born. So leave your troubles behind and embark on an adventure led by our own pirate captain as he plots the course for your trip. Theatrical lighting and special effects will surround you as you play through the themed areas of our course, searching for an out-of-the-ordinary, quote-unquote, treasure.
That's exactly what it is.
What was the treasure? Did you get anything?
The treasure was beating my girlfriend really badly at minigolf.
Yo. Owned. All right, well, I'm glad you had a good time.
It was really fun.
I'm glad
honestly,
they have a Pac-Man cabinet dressed up like it's like a crate.
See, that's what I meant with the straw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got you. Cool.
It was extremely fun if you like really cheesy things, which I do. I truly love cheesy things. It was wonderful. I had a great time. And I love the acting.
I don't feel like I have anything to bring even close to that to show and tell today. Rob, Patrick, did y'all go on any treasure cruises or?
Nah, man. I was trying to figure out how reasonable it would be if I could actually just farm Monster Hunter creatures during the podcast recording.
I've dealt with worse than podcast recording. I've been around that.
I spent this weekend, so I was out of town, but in a position where I brought my PS4 because I knew I'd have like some downtime, but not the kind of downtime where I could like seriously commit to getting a whole lot done. So I thought like, well, I'll bring my PS4 with, and you know, maybe I could like just like do some grinding. Like this would be an opportunity to do the sort of stuff that I don't want to do when like I have like main time to play a game, but that with time that otherwise is only like 40 minutes, I could squeeze something in. So I basically like kind of put the story on Monster Hunter on pause. And now I just want to fill out now that I've like committed to the hammer. At some point I'll go experiment with like some other weapons and stuff. Yeah. But like I'm really happy with the hammer. Every couple of hours I'm still discovering new things with it. So it's like, I'm still finding a lot of satisfaction with the actual depth of that, of that weapon. So at this point, what I want to do is like make sure that I can go into fights like feeling like really confident about what I've equipped. Like I used the poison weapons for like the first 25 hours, and then in the last 10 to 15, I've been slowly trying to kind of like, oh, I should get some other ones. And now I'm just like, once you've collected like six of them, it's like, yeah. Well, now I should just do the whole damn thing. It's just like it's like I have like when I look and see like, oh, like I could go into I can only do like a when I'm looking at the strength chart or the weakness chart of the monsters. And it's like, I've got nothing that does a three. Like, why don't I have a sleep hammer?
Right.
It's like, I don't know, because I haven't spent the time.
Go make a sleep hammer.
So that's what I'm doing. Like, I've probably gotten
wow,
a
you're
little
the
over half
all
of the hammers.
The way in. You're at, like, Destiny level of, like, I have to kit myself out for every eventuality. Oh, I'm going to just grind it out.
Yeah, and I think like what my open thread this week might be about is that it's been nice to find a new podcast game, which I think we've talked about, Monster Hunter, in that context before, where I'm usually sort of I'm not against grinding as a concept, but grinding and execution in most games I find to be tedious and not particularly enthralling. But that's often because it's purely a time sink as opposed to there being anything sort of mechanically interesting about what you're doing during that grind.
Right.
And so, like, I think for a lot of people in Destiny, which is a game, you know, for whatever improvements happened in Destiny 2, was still a game that was still a lot about grinding. But, like, the basic, like, left trigger, right trigger was still satisfying a lot of the time, even if you were doing repetitive actions. And in Monster Hunter, I have found, even when I'm just going and recapturing the same monster three times in a row, like, what I've noticed is like, okay, this time I'm going to try and figure out how I use this one particular attack that I never used with the hammer. Like I hadn't figured out how to do like, so with the hammer, you have this charging variable. And so if you hold a charge, then you can change what your default attack is. And there are various stages to that. And I never used the second stage one, which is where he kind of dashes forward and hits up.
Right.
And it turns out that's like extremely useful for like an Anjanath, like the T-Rex enemy that has its head hovering slightly above the ground. So
right.
You can't actually get it on a left to right one. And doing the up to down is extremely slow. But if you do the charge, it's a very quick up to down. It's like, oh, right. Now that completely changes how I'm going to approach different combat scenarios. So in the actual grind, I'm finding depth in the weapon that I've sort of like chosen as my main. And it's 100% the game has its hooks in me. And like, it's actually been nice. The games are as kind of slow as they are right now, because I don't feel this like immediate temptation or even need through like what I just need to do professionally to go do something else. Like
right.
I just am playing more Monster Hunter and I'm finding deeply satisfying.
It's
so
funny.
Far.
We've had conversations in the past couple of weeks about like what makes a game or a piece of media like breach through and like become the big talking point. I know on Idle Weekend, Rob and Danielle, you all talked about this with relation to Bloodborne. Like our whole community suddenly everyone was playing Bloodborne. Like we had everybody who the people who wrote for us, people who on the staff, Natalie is playing Bloodborne again, and it seemed to like pierced through. And we didn't talk about that in terms of Monster Hunter because it was a new release, so it seemed like, oh, of course, it's a new game, and that means that it can get its hooks into people. But, like, I think it's actually interesting to think about even Monster Hunter in that way because plenty of new good games come out and don't find audiences. And I think Monster Hunter is really great. I don't know that it's better than this game or that game that has come out over the last year or two that has a similar amount of depth. You know what I mean? I'm sure if we put our heads together, we would come up with like five things that were, you know, yeah, pretty good, but maybe didn't find the same huge buy-in given their amount of depth. And it's interesting to see that just like, oh yeah, there's space for it right now. They found that right delivery moment where, yeah, like people who traditionally would have to move on to something else or would return to, like, I think Destiny 2 not being good Destiny 2 Destiny 2 not having the legs that Destiny 1 had with that audience.
There's a lot of fall off. A lot of people, yeah, are like not like hardcore fan. I'm sure, yes, we all know a lot of, and some of, you know, Austin, you played a lot of Destiny far more than
I did.
Like all the people I know that continued on that that bicycle of Destiny,
yeah,
have basically fallen off. A lot of them have gone to Monster Hunter. A lot of them have just gone on to different things. And I do think there was a confluence of, yeah, like games like Destiny, which like are, you know, these games as a service, like a lot of people dropped off, and Monster Hunter came at a time where there's just not that much else out. And because it seemed like there was a big pitch of like, hey, you know, this is a good one, this is a good beginner one, I think there were a lot of people that just said, like, kind of held their nose and went, okay, like, I'm gonna give this a go. And that was definitely me. I did not go into it thinking it was going to get it. I figured I could come out of it going, at the very least, oh, I get it now.
Yeah.
But now it's gone beyond that, where it's just like, no, like, this is just what I want to spend my time with. And it's also interesting, I don't know if this will continue to be a tradition for Capcom, but they have now twice in a row done hugely important, like, company-defining releases at the end of January, in which they have announced the game just at the E3 prior. This happened for Resident Evil 7.
Yeah.
It was announced, revealed, and then came out the following January. And Monster Hunter World was announced, revealed, and came out the following January. And, like, they either I'm not sure if it's purposeful or it's delayed. Like, I don't know what's happening, or if they're just saying in a sort of a – this happens in Hollywood a lot, where folks just kind of, like, stake out a date far in advance and, like, places just kind of stay away from it.
Right.
I wonder if Capcom is just sort of saying, like, hey, we're finding a lot of traction in just sort of, like – because if Monster Hunter came out in, like, late October of last year
– buried.
Like, I wouldn't have given it the time of day. Like, that I wouldn't have done this and – like, it coming out in late January means that I think a lot more people have been able to give it the time of day that it might not otherwise.
That's one of those things that makes our jobs really weird, is that, like, if this was a film, you would have made time for it. It would have been a two-hour, let's say a three-hour film. It would have been, oh, it's a very challenging movie. You know, it has its –
got to see it twice.
Got to see it twice, you know, to really wrap your head around it. It's 3 hours long. But you would still have made the time for it because you would have been able,
right,
to. But, like – when there's a busy gaming season, like, it pushes us into our biases so strong. And, like, I generally think that that's okay as long as you own up to it and say, like, here is why I'm playing the things I'm playing, and, like, my interests are my interests, and, like, I want to cover the stuff that really moves me and blah, blah, blah. But, like, it's just one of those really instructive instances that says, like, hey, here's a thing that you now really like that you would not have known you would have liked, that you would not have given the time of day to, that – it's frustrating in a weird way. It's like, I wish we could just jump over that 20-hour hump to know, right, if you would like the thing. And, like, you can't. You got to put in the time to do it. You have to do it.
But it's just nice. Like, now I have, like, it's exciting to have, like, a whole new series. Like, I'm probably – at this point, I've played, like, 40 hours of Monster Hunter World. Like, I can easily see myself, like, pushing 100 on it, mm-hmm, by the end of it. But it's exciting to be, like, already be, like, I'm excited for whatever the sequel is.
Right.
Not because, like, I want to get to it, but just, like, it's cool to have a new track of game that, like, when I see a logo come up, I'm going to go, oh, shit, like, I'm excited to play this game. Like, it's exciting because you do get into your lanes,
yeah,
and it's exciting to have a new lane. And then on top of that, the amount of time and effort I put into learning this means essentially I'll have scratched off 20 hours of, like, what?
Yeah,
when I play,
dude,
whatever the next one is. Like, the next one I play, I'll just be able to jump in and be like, here, I know what I want out of this game. I'm going to just jump in and start doing it. And at that point, you're just learning the nuances of the new thing as opposed to, like, I don't know what, you know, what's going on here. And, like, that's super exciting.
Yeah, I think that, about that a lot, Danielle, with immersive sims. Like, think about how quick you were able to take to the mini golf course because, like, you have all those hours of immersive sims.
Playing so much Prey that mini golf is really,
But I do think about, like, oh, one of the reasons why it's you're able to engage with Prey so quickly and easily, or, like, engage with, not even easily, quickly, but with its depth, is like, oh, a fascination with and a knowledge of that space. And then Rob, like, so you've been playing Civ 6, and we should talk about Rise and Fall, which is the new expansion, but, like, strategy games are this to a huge degree, because you not only are coming into any specific strategy game with knowledge of its history and series and like, even a specific developer, you know what I mean? Like, you know what you're getting when you're getting a Firaxis game versus a Paradox game versus a Matrix game or whatever. Like, to some degree, there is a shared language of UI and certain sorts of, like, focuses and stuff like that. But also, like, especially inside of a series, like a Civ, like, okay, here are the key things that I don't – they can just chop those right off the top of – becoming acquainted with the game, and instead can start to become acquainted with whatever the new thing is bringing. So tell me about
the game instead of the genre.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Or, like, and in some cases in strategy, there are so many subgenres that are, like, it's just a very complicated space. But tell me about Rise and Fall, Civ 6. This is the new expansion that's out now or out soon?
Yeah. It's out now.
Okay.
And I'm going to have to collect my thoughts a little bit because I'm still trying to figure out if that was an actual segue or whether it was just the form of a segue and then a new topic.
It's both.
Yeah, I'm like racking my brain. I'm like, was that like a brilliant segue that I didn't see?
Yeah,
or is that just
like
veteran podcast hosting where you're like, this sounds related?
It's both. I think it was related. I know you've been playing it.
He
so
hit the kick behind the jab is what he did.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
To your point, though, what you're talking about, like, development and change within a series, I think Civilization VI was already in kind of a strange place in reference to the rest of the Civilization franchise, and then Rise and Fall makes things even weirder.
For people who, like, maybe have kind of come in and out of Civs over the years, what is the general distinguishing character of Civ 6 versus 4 or 5 or 3 or 2 or the first
one?
Oh,
man. Okay.
Very broad picture here. I know. Yeah.
Okay. So I would say, but to okay, so Civilizations 1 through 4 had a great deal of consistency and carryover between them in terms of the language they employed, the way they worked, in terms of, like, combat, the way you built your civilization.
You build, like, big stacks of things and you crush them, right? You throw, like,
yeah,
a thousand,
that was the Stacks of Doom era is what they were called. You could stack several units into one square and then you could move them all at once.
Right.
And in late game wars, it was just endless stacks being thrown at each other until math won out, basically. So Civilization IV was kind of the end of the line for that style of design. And it would be, I don't want to completely flatten the differences between those first four games, but Civilization IV still felt consistent with a lot of them. Civilization V broke a lot of those traditions. It basically eliminated the Stacks of Doom and became a much more, in some ways, board gamey civilization. It became very, like, focused on endgame from the start. And this is one of the complaints about the game, which was that Civilization V was kind of a expert mode Civ in some ways. Like, you really needed to know everything you were going to encounter from the moment you started your game. And then you really needed to, as well as you possibly could, stay on script for the entire game.
So
which
not
is really
a game
demanding.
Of, right. It's not a game about, like dipping your toes in various things. You're like, oh, actually, I want to try some cultural stuff here. Oh, now I want to try some stuff in economy. Now I want to be a little bit of a, maybe for this next, like, the 100 years of play or whatever, I'm going to be military focused. You couldn't really do that.
Right. Because if you didn't sort of stay on the power curve for each of those strategies, you fell off so fast that you would never be able to arrive at the victory conditions in the end game.
Gotcha.
The other thing is they imposed a lot of penalties for overexpansion. So, like, if you wanted to do a cultural victory, for instance, if you built a bunch of cities, you basically couldn't do that. So you couldn't explore and, like, cover the world in more of your cities. You really had to, again, from the first, like, you know, opening stages of the game, say, I'm committed to culture, and here are the two or three cities I'm going to build, gotcha. And that's it. Civilization VI retains the form of Civilization V. Like, superficially, they look a lot alike. But it actually becomes very much about contingent factors, I guess is the way I'd put it. Like, in most Civilization games, a city is a city is a city. You can build, you just keep putting buildings into those cities, and they live in the city, and they change the stats for the city. The city is a one-tile, like, unit that collects all those stats.
Right, so it's like if the map of the world in Civilization is a board, previously cities were one spot on the map.
Right. Civilization VI came along and was like, cities actually need to expand. Right. They need to have districts. And actually, it doesn't make sense that you can, like, build the pyramids in the jungle. That's not where pyramids go. They have to go in the desert.
Well, Egyptian pyramids, anyway. Like, yeah. That's that specific. I get what you're saying.
Yeah. The Great Pyramids. Whatever.
Yeah, sorry. I read a story recently about how archaeologists discovered...
Oh, the Maya?
The fucking Mayan shit is incredible with using lasers. They discovered, like, tons of new villages and, like, a huge expansive city. Yeah. Our focus on history is wild. Anyway, sorry. Yes, the Great Pyramids, desert. Got it.
Yeah, so... But all these various wonders, all these different building types suddenly become geographically... focus. They become dependent on geography,
which means a waterway for a fishery. You need to have, like, literally a block of a certain type of stone to build a certain sort of masonry or whatever, or to build the Hanging Gardens, you need to have a certain sort of location.
I mean, river access, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And so what that changes, how that changes things is suddenly the map becomes a much more interesting place because you're not just looking for good base stats and then you can build whatever there. Suddenly, like, you're going along and you see really fertile, like, riverlands bordering a desert. And you get really excited because you're like, I can build a bunch of desert buildings there,
and
but,
also,
like, I'll still have all this farmable land.
Right, this is how you get Cairo, right? Like, this is how you get the Nile River Basin or whatever, right? Which is like, oh, wow, like, this is a unique character to a city instead of just, like, this is a min-maxed city. This feels like it has a certain real, like, placeness, a real there-ness that reflects the conditions that it grew up in, or that it grew up in as a person, as a little baby city.
A little baby
village turned into
a city.
Right, exactly.
It has some growing pains, and then it's an old city,
And it still, you know, has all the wounds, but it has a lot of character, too. Yeah. Anyway.
So, where this gets really wild is that if you think about it, you're not going to see, like, every game you're going to be seeing these different combinations of geography. And there's also adjacency.
Right, because there isn't, for people who haven't played Civ, real quick, the maps aren't just, it's not just Earth. There's, like, randomly generated maps that you can have a bunch of different sliders to produce various effects, like how many islands you want, how close are rivers together, shit like that. I don't know if that's a specific one, but stuff like that generally. Cool.
So you'll be seeing different, like, map layouts each time. And you have to be able to interpret all of that each game in order to make the best decisions, to know, like, in order to, like, sort of plan for the future. You kind of need to know how these geographic elements are going to come into play, how the adjacencies are going to work, how wonder bonuses are going to work, and how you're going to basically make the most effective and efficient cities out of all these variable elements.
So still, you know, expertise
as you go.
But this is like expertise about reading a map versus expertise about memorizing a tree, like memorizing a formula or something. Or is it still both?
That's the it's both.
Okay.
They've made it much more complicated. Like, you still need to know what the wonders do. You still need and they've also changed that up a lot. So, like, there was a lot of consistency, or at least you always sort of had a sense of, like, what the Great Library was going to do in the first like four games. Mm-hmm. In this one, they've started to, like, the wonders have effects that feel a little bit different than they have in the past. It's hard for me to put my finger on, but, like, it no longer feels like past experience with Civs is as much of a useful guide in this one. Like, you really have, like, I am sort of relearning Civ in a way I haven't had to learn Civ basically since, like, Civ 2.
Right.
Which is really exciting. But Civilization VI has not caught on the way Civ 5 did.
Right.
And I think one of the reasons for that is because it kind of takes all your previous like knowledge and what you've sort of spent the series sort of mastering. And it's like, well, that's worthless now, and shreds it. And the thing is, until you've been through a few games and you start to learn these new rules and these new dynamics, it's a really difficult game to parse and navigate. It's hard to make good decisions in this new civilization without having internalized all these different factors and played with them a bunch of times.
Right, this is the Monster Hunter thing again, basically, except what if next time Monster Hunter threw out the control scheme and started – went back to the PS2 control scheme where all the attacks were on the right stick or whatever.
Wait, is that true?
Yo, dude, yeah.
What?
Yeah, that's
awesome. Did you Austin, not, we got to play that. We got to play that. The OG Monster Hunter.
I want to figure out how to play it real bad because, yes, all of the. Yeah, look at Monster Hunter 1 controls at some point. They're wild. Anyway,
okay,
it's like
sure.
It's like that because except that you've played hundreds of hours of Civ before, and now you have to start fresh. And then on top of that, Rise and Fall is then more
Rise and Fall comes along and adds a lot more. Rise and Fall is like Civilization, to some extent, dreaming of being a Paradox game in some ways. Or
so like,
how
many people can I get? Can I infect with syphilis? How many demons are possessing my?
Not quite like that.
Okay.
No, it's not trying to be Crusader Kings, but maybe it's more like EU4.
Gotcha.
And the one of the big dynamics it's introducing is Dark Ages and Golden Ages.
Okay. This actually sounds a lot like... We can continue real quick, but a lot of what you're describing sounds a lot like Endless Legend to me in terms of districting and like...
Oh, yep.
And like these like Golden Ages versus kind of Dark Ages stuff. Is that a fair comparison? And also like tactical combat and like the tiles all meaning something. Okay.
That's an extremely fair comparison. It was striking how quickly Civ was like, we got districts now.
Okay.
Within like 9 months of Endless Legend coming out. So this is 100% like the Civ that was sort of went to school on Endless Legend. But with the Golden Ages and the Dark Ages, in each era, and it sort of proceeds according to the classic epochs that the Civ series is always traded in, so classical, ancient, modern, whatever. You have certain events that happen. So if you build a wonder, you get like +3 era points or something.
Okay.
You accrue enough of them in your era, you get a golden age.
Okay.
And you get like
that's cool.
Bonuses throughout the next era.
How many golden era points do you think America in 2018 has racked up?
Well, so that brings us to the Dark Age concept. And the Dark Age concept is you came in, like, you were basically running on empty. You didn't do much with the previous era. You're in a new era, and you're playing from behind. And you've got a lot of penalties against you. And there's going to be a lot of things that just, like, make everything a little bit slower and harder and dumber than they were in the previous era. So it's no longer neutral. It's like you're a little bit, like, you know, you're running with weights in some ways.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah, it sounds familiar to me. can't say that sounds great, but also I live it. Okay.
Sounds like life, yeah.
Yeah, and then the other dynamic is they want to have different alliance types. So that like alliances in the past have been very... I mean, starting with Civ 5, diplomacy in Civ just started becoming very boring in some ways. Like there wasn't much interaction that you could have with the AI leaders.
Yeah, it's a lot of like, you'll join my alliance if you send me X number of research or whatever, like wheat barrels.
Right. And a lot of times, why would you even want that? Because it was like, okay, I guess like unless I'm worried about somebody invading me, I don't need an ally really. And I can always create like a research agreement with somebody else, which follows different rules. Now you have different alliances for different types of relationships. So you can have like a cultural alliance where each side of the alliance will start getting like base level culture bonuses each turn,
right?
As long as the alliance is in effect. And the longer the alliance endures, the more the alliance levels up and becomes increasingly powerful. So there's incentive to have like long-term buddies in the game that like, oh, our people have been sort of united for 1,000 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Like for like, if you're like, you have your whole nation built next to a city state and you've been trading stuff, you're in the age of cars, but y'all have been friends since you've been trading wool back and forth. Like,
when you were wheat buddies.
When you were wheat buddies, back in the day. Yeah. The age of my wheat buddies.
My good old wheat buddies.
Patrick's making a bad face. Yeah. I actually think that makes a lot more sense. Like, what is the degree of interaction between those now? Like, besides just you get more buffs, because like if that's just like they'll give me a better trade deal and I don't have to really care about it, but the number is higher, that doesn't really communicate much about them as like a culture or people, you know?
Yeah. And that's why I'm not sure it's a totally successful mechanic.
Okay, gotcha. Like,
so sometimes your allies will sort of bring things to a close because for whatever reason you've kind of like they feel you've run your course.
Mm-hmm.
And they no longer need you. The more like you can only have one kind of agreement at a time, so you can't have like multiple science allies, for instance. So you have to pick like who's going to be my science buddy.
Mm-hmm.
You probably don't want that person to be Montezuma is probably not a great science buddy because like he's probably going to be so expansionistic that he's not really investing a ton in like tech development.
Right.
He's all about planting new towns. He's a great economic partner because he has tons of resources, tons of cities he can trade with, but like not for science. Korea has great science. So in general, you want to like try to like have a science alliance with a country like Korea.
What was that one? A science alliance?
Science alliance.
A science alliance.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Say that three times fast.
Hashtag science alliance. That's my new it's not a nonprofit, but it is one of those corps that doesn't need to make profit. Like
we'll
take
your
money. It's a bullshit PAC.
Don't be evil.
Right. Yeah, it's a pack. It's definitely my new STEM pack.
You gonna start selling flamethrowers?
You know, one thing at a time. We like to call them flame movers. They move flames around. Yeah. We don't throw them. Throwing is dangerous, Patrick. We don't like to
people kill people. Flamethrowers move flames.
Move flames. Uh-huh. It's completely different entirely.
Right, absolutely.
I'm sorry to ruin your science alliance. I'm sorry to be Montezuma here.
So the point is, though, it's like it does add some new dimensions. Mm-hmm. It also feels a little bit fussy. And it also doesn't always feel like it's under great control because, like, sometimes it just feels like your ally or your ex-ally is just kind of making bizarre moves for whatever reason to sort of terminate the alliance.
And then sounds like my exes too. Shit.
Yep.
And then two turns later, they're like, let's get back together.
Yeah.
And but you're like, you've reset the relationship to level one.
Right.
Like, what are you doing?
We had all this history. I already moved my toothbrush back to my place.
We used to be wheat buddies.
Oh, remember when we were wheat buddies? We can't go back to being wheat buddies.
And so, and then with the eras thing, it can also feel a little bit like the way you get era points just kind of happens to you. Like it's somewhat under control, but like also it feels like there's an sort of inherent momentum to the way things go with each period.
Right.
That it doesn't feel
like it's happening to you. You're not like working towards it.
Yeah. Like you can influence the direction that things are going, but it doesn't feel like you can exactly steer it the way you can other elements of civilization.
Is that like a bad thing though? Because I kind of like the notion. So the comparison I was making to Endless Legend before is that it has like a weather system where like it has these winters that come and slow everything down and are like they make it hard to move. They reduce your economic gains. Everyone's just kind of stuck in place. And the strength of that is that you don't control it and you can like anticipate that it's coming, but like I can't stave off the winter. And I kind of like the notion of a strategy game. It's why I like Paradox games, which is like sometimes the golden horde comes from the east and like sometimes the plague spreads through my towns and like I don't have control of that. I can prep for it because I know it might be coming, but like it's gonna fucking hit me. And I like that notion of things I can only limitedly push and not necessarily direct towards my benefit, you know? But I guess that the thing is, like, Civ is a game about maxing out your potential, right?
But there's the thing. Civ as a franchise, based on previous experience, is about that.
Right.
But we always say, like, we want a series to change things up. Yeah, we want it to be dynamic and, like, stop making the same game. So the last two games especially for Axis have been, like, fine.
We're
not going to make the same game.
Yeah.
And immediately, and to an extent, I'm still having this reaction, is like, well, wait, but now it doesn't feel like Civ.
Right.
Like, I wanted, sorry, like, I wanted my familiar, like, comfort food.
Right.
And now you're introducing all this stuff. Now, some of it does just, I think, kind of suck. Like, there's also governors that you appoint, and they provide bonuses to each city. You can choose from a menu of seven. They have limited little skill trees.
It's the same seven all the time?
Yeah, and the same skill tree. So it feels super bolted on.
Yeah.
And, like, it doesn't feel very interesting.
That's like, I call, I'm not going to diss this. I'm sure there's a lot of reason for why they arrive at that decision. But what I was going to say is, like, that does feel very, like you said, bolted on is a good one. But also just, like, it feels like a very competent mod versus what I want to and what I love from big budget, like, major strategy game expansions. Like, when I think about XCOM's War of the Chosen, like, that stuff feels beyond what I'd seen from what is already a very competent and strong mod community. But, like, oh, wow, yeah, like, you know, light procedural generation around certain enemies, this entire bonding system. Like, the bonding system maybe in War of the Chosen feels a little bolted on, but, like, so much of the rest of it, entire new factions feel, like, so comprehensive and complex that it feels like it's like coming from the resources of a big studio, whereas like one of these seven people who each has one tree, like that's a really good mod. Like, that doesn't necessarily feel like the heart of it.
They do not feel like they even live in the same game.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Like, it's seven randos that you're like, oh, this is the educator. And, like, two of his abilities have to do with, like, science and education, and then the rest is like, and also nuclear bombs. Like, you know, okay, I guess, but like,
yeah, he'll educate you about who not to fuck with. Learn your lesson.
Oh my god,
that's right.
When the educator is ready to present you with your diploma, you know shit's about to get real.
It's a funny thing to write on the front of a bomb. Jeez. God.
It's elaborate.
Well, I'm looking forward. You're going to write about this week for us. I'm looking forward to your final takeaway thoughts. I'm looking forward to, like, editing them, because it sounds like you have a lot of big ideas, and I'm excited to help those reach the masses as best
the
as we can.
The educator without the bomb.
No, I think Rob Zachney carries that bomb. I think
he's
Rob Zachney
drop
is
that bomb.
We'll figure out what type of governor Rob Zachney is for sure. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come right back, and I'm going to talk about something else that has maybe a loose handle on controls and bigger ambitions greater ambitions than its reach. Than its grasp. Further reach than grasp? Yes, that's it. That's it. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Dynasty Warriors.
Oh.
Everyone loves it. Everyone's favorite series.
Wait, what?
Everyone on this call loves Dynasty Warriors.
Whoa.
That's what I've heard. The adventures of Lu Bu and Cao Cao, everyone's favorite characters. This is a joke, but like I know who all these characters are and what happened with them.
Okay, so
Dong Zhuo, who is this kind of like shitty corrupt bureaucrat, he's like, oh well, what I really need is like an enforcer, and so he lures Lu Bu to him using Diao Chan, who is just a really lovable lady who like can play an instrument and like can soothe the monstrous kind of warrior Lu Bu.
Using her instrument?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lu Bu kills a bunch of people. He has a horse. It's called Red Hair. Lu Bu among men, red hair among horses. Obviously, we all know this classic line from Romance of the Three Kingdoms, the multi-volume epic. No? No one here plays these games except me.
I played one.
Which one?
It was almost exactly 5 years ago because it was supposed to be my very first review for Polygon, and I couldn't find anything to say about it, so that got scrapped a little bit. But
happens.
I did play whatever came out almost exactly 5 years ago.
It could have been any number of
Dynasty Warriors something.
I mean, I prefer Romance of the Three Kingdoms, yeah, which is the historical strategy series about this exact period.
It's the actual problem. Is I could go into deep, deep detail about which of those are my favorites because that's the motherfucker I am.
But anyway, Lu Bu, the unkillable guy that like destroys your entire army while you're off fighting some shitty underboss.
Yeah, I beat him on Saturday. He was all right. Okay. He was kind of a mini boss. It wasn't a big deal this time. So Dynasty Warriors 9. Oh, okay. Let's actually have a Dynasty Warriors talk real briefly. Okay. Real briefly. Dynasty Warriors as a series has been really weird because it's gone through a lot of changes that have not been clear to an outside perspective. Because how could it be all you're doing is hitting square and triangle 1,000 times per minute to kill as many dudes as possible? But if you're like me, someone who's followed that series since the first like fighting game, since like the one-on-one fighting game that was Dynasty Warriors 1, that was just like a traditional side. Like,
I didn't realize
that. Yeah, 100%. Okay. Dynasty Warriors 2 is what turns it into this kind of 3D beat-em-up. Every couple of years, it reinvents itself as best as it can. Sometimes it's a very minor change. It's more characters. It's different costumes. It's maybe a new combo system. Sometimes it's a bit larger in terms of like the structure of what the game is.
Strategy elements and such.
So those tend to be like sub-releases inside, right? So like the Empires sub-series will come out for like Dynasty Warriors 3 Empires, Dynasty Warriors 5 Empires. I like the Empires games quite a bit because they give you this like little – they give you something else to do besides – to like care about as far as gaming goes besides
just – put out some orders and such.
Put out some orders and such. Yeah, exactly. And it's goofy and people have favorite characters. It's a lot like a fighting game franchise or like an anime in that like everyone has their favorite their favorite characters, their favorite side. They're all the different empires. It is the Romance of the Three Kingdoms. There are kind of four major kingdoms throughout that period of time. Because one of them kind of evolves out of one of the other ones.
I see.
And at no point are the fourth one and one of the earlier ones kind of in the picture at the same time, really, kind of.
So there's
it's
always three kingdoms, even though...
There's always a lighthouse. Kind of there's always three kingdoms.
Okay.
There's always...
Yep.
Stop it.
A strategist.
Stop it.
Okay.
Dynasty Warriors Infinite.
Right. So here's the real important thing is I think over the last like last three years, I'd say... Koei Tecmo has done a lot of experimenting inside of the space. I think you can point at like Hyrule Warriors as the first one to really mix it up in terms of like character abilities. I mean, that's not true. The Warriors Orochi series, which was like their weird mashup of samurai and dynasty warriors, where it was like samurai plus like ancient Chinese warriors together fighting demon lords.
At last.
Finally.
So just Avengers,
Yu,
fuck that.
And
this is what people were waiting
I know.
For.
I mean, those games all sell really well is an important note.
Oh, of course.
People love these games.
Absolutely.
But in that series, they started messing around with things like tag-out systems, like Marvel style, but with Dynasty Warriors. And then by the time you get to Hyrule Warriors, they're doing special abilities a little bit differently. They're doing just different sorts of like mission objectives. And then they've done that with all of their spin-offs, except for Gundam, which has always been kind of bad, which obviously
There's
disappoints
a Gundam
me.
Spin-off.
Dynasty Warriors Gundam has had four entries. Yeah. It's wild.
Today.
But then there's like – they've done different anime ones. They've done the – Berserk one, I think, most recently. They did...
What was that? They did the Fire Emblem,
one which
last
is,
year.
Which, okay, so the Fire Emblem one is a really great example. Fire Emblem one has the weapons triangle from Fire Emblem in it. So, like, spear units do better against sword units.
Oh, interesting.
The sword units do better against axe units. Axe units do better against spear units or whatever that triangle is. There are Pegasi in that game, and archers fuck them up. You know, like, and you can give directions in
right.
that game. You can like say, "Hey, send my Pegasus troop here," and then like, "Oh no, they deployed an archer troop. That's not good. Got to pull them out." And you can jump around from different perspectives and like play the different named characters from the Fire Emblem universe. So like, that's another good example of that. The Dragon Quest Warriors that came out last year. But you it was kind of like let you grind in like an open world a little bit and go out and fight random monsters in a place around the town. They put out a game last year called Story of Sonata, which is like a samurai warriors game, but with like a heavy character focus with like cutscenes, and it's all about this one family inside of the samurai warriors Sengoku Japan era Warring States period. It's just about this one family and about like the relationship between parents and children and cousins and like who are these people fighting for their clan. And like, so they've done all these experiments in a way that's made me super excited for Dynasty Warriors 9. Up until recently, here's all I knew about Dynasty Warriors 9. It was going to have an open world.
Wow.
And it was going to have grappling hooks. Those, and also, I think, 90 characters, which immediately made me nervous. That's too many characters.
characters with 10 different, like...
No, I mean, it isn't. Like, there's a little bit more differentiation than that, believe it or not. It's more like 25 characters with, like, 4 different variations.
Okay.
But, or whatever it is, but...
Oh, my guess is their definition of open world may be varied from what most people might think an open world
one,
means.
Yes. Two, two, the lack of focus on the storytelling is like garbage here is like, and I'm coming from Dynasty Warriors, to be clear. Like, I'm saying as a person who.
It's garbage here within the expectations of Dynasty Warriors.
I will never forget, and I'll probably write about this for my open thread this week, what it meant the first time I saw Lu Bu in Dynasty Warriors 2, because Lu Bu was fucking unbeatable. Like, there's a cutscene, Lu Bu comes out, they tell you not to pursue Lu Bu, you should not pursue Lu Bu, and then you shouldn't.
But you do.
You shouldn't do it in Dynasty Warriors 2.
Oh.
He's set up to like auto heal every time he gets knocked down 100%. And he's a limited number of those. He's like 30 of those or something. But every time you knock him down, he can heal himself. And so young Austin was like, all right, I'm going to win by never knocking him down. I'm just going to keep him up on his feet the whole time. I'm going to like reverse rope-a-dope him. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And so like I have this very clear memory of that being a really hard fight. And I like never beat it. It took me 3 years before I would actually be able to beat Lu Bu. And that was this moment of like, oh no, I'm just going to go around him. What I'm supposed to do is just ignore him and go after the objective. Go kill Dong Zhuo, who is not a big deal. He's just a...
Can you kill him, though?
Yes, you can. You can. It was like this early moment of like, they took the text as real. Lu Bu is unbeatable, or is he? If you really work at it, you can totally win that fight. So it's a pretty cool thing. And so like... Through 3, through 4, there are all these moments of like fun, goofy storytelling. There's a dance number in one of them. There's
that's awesome.
It's, you know what it is? Dynasty Warriors, you know the Tekken endings? Like goofy ass.
Yes.
Dynasty Warriors inherited that sort of absurdity and humor. And in general, like those cutscenes looked about like what cutscenes should look like in a given platform era. Now, like, I played this game for 5 or 6 hours, and there's, like, maybe 1 or 2 things that we would think of as a cutscene. Everything else is just, like, 3 or 4 or 7 characters standing on a screen, walking in from stage left, walking out stage right, another different character. It's like a stage play, but on, like, really muddy textures, really bad backgrounds. And, yeah, as an open world goes, no. Like, there are... fortresses. It's a map of the entire map of China. Like, Rob, it's like, it is like the Romance of the Three Kingdoms map of China, but you can walk around it or ride a horse around it to all the different cities. But it's not the thing you're thinking. It's not like...
I'm thinking, holy shit, they made Mountain Blade.
Right, it is, right, but they don't do it like Mountain Blade, because it's still, instead of being, you're in the open, like, that is what I wanted. When they first pitched this to me, I wanted Mountain Blade, which was, like, procedural, like, I mean, it's a map, the map is set, but, like, all these different kingdoms are all fighting over everything, and you're just one soldier inside of it, and, like, how can you push and pull on these forces in order to let one of these kingdoms rise and take over? And that is not what it is at all. Mm. It's story missions with side quests that you fast travel around the map. There are towers you climb to add more icons to your map.
No.
There are crafting materials all over the place. There are level 28 bears you have to kill. It's they were like, what if Dynasty Warriors was made by like 2012 era Ubisoft? But also, it's like also like 2015 era Ubisoft, because it's super janky and broken. I'm playing on the PS4 Pro, and I've had the frame rate drop to like 12, 10 frames. It doesn't take up...
I mean, that series has always had frame rate
this
issues,
this is worse than it's ever
like
been
historically.
In my life. And also, I'm playing on a PS4 Pro. Also, it doesn't take up the full screen. There's a black bar around the entire...
That explains...
And I'm playing in action mode, not resolution mode. So
that's bad. That means the game's technical shortcomings that's one of the few times. Like, I don't watch a lot of like the Digital Foundry does excellent work, but I just am not usually particularly interested in watching like technical breakdowns. That's just not my thing. But occasionally, I do like to watch them. This sounds like the kind of game where I might watch the technical breakdown.
And it's so frustrating because I can see the ambition on the page. It's cool. You can zoom out. You're getting notifications constantly of the battles that are happening across China as these forces move around. But, like, it sucks. Like, it's just not good. It feels bad. There's a new combo system that feels kind of cool. There's, like, counters in this game now that feel all right.
Do you think the Dynasty Warriors B team got this one or something like that?
It's Dynasty Warriors 9.
I know.
It's the numbered entry.
It's weird.
And so, here's my guess is that... you know, there has been this movement in the last like 5 years. We've seen like some Japanese game, like two of the most prime examples of Japanese developers looking at like specifically Ubisoft, but generally like a Western push towards like systems and systemic integration and the what we usually associate with the term open world. I think there's a lot of healthy skepticism that like Metal Gear was able to pull it off, and while Metal Gear doesn't have a whole ton of like systemic stuff happening in its world, it's a very successful open world in that vein. Yeah. Like, it made the translation very well, and Metal Gear Solid 5, like, the story stuff largely aside, like, was a ton of fun to play and benefited from, like,
really
the
nice
bigger
sandbox.
playground
it's
put into.
It's definitely, like, in that Far Cry genre space of, like, I have these toys, the enemy is kind of trying to counter those toys, how do I best, like, sneak around and set mines and trick them into doing bullshit, and it's fun, it's great.
Right, so it found, like, how Metal Gear works in that world, and then Nintendo also did it with Breath of the Wild last year, and so
there's precedent of it.
Those
working.
Two games did it. Those games did it pretty successfully and seemingly effortlessly.
Dragon's Dogma.
But I think
also,
what's like,
I just want to say, for instance,
throw that out.
Dragon's Dogma.
Whatever, that game didn't have. Remember the fast travel in that game?
They fixed
Come on.
That. And also, I like that. I'm the one who liked that not having that because I'm that motherfucker.
I like it. I liked it on paper. Like when I would tell people, like, I think it's cool what they did. But then I'd play the game and go, like, just let me fucking fast travel. Like
they fixed it.
But I'm just saying, like it was made it seem seemingly effortless to like just drop these like traditional Japanese games, fuse them with some Western open world sort of mentality, and like poof, like you get like a brand new game. And like actually the reality is like doing that shit's like really hard. And Dynasty Warriors may be like an example of just like you can't just necessarily plug and, and play it. Like there's actually a lot of like heavy.
And that was kind of my question for you, Austin. Is you're saying like I can see the ambition, but there's a line between like genuine ambition and then like commercial Me Too-ism.
Yeah.
And, like, does it feel like there's, like, sort of a heart and soul underneath this design? Or does it literally feel like they just sort of Frankenstein together a bunch of, like old, shabbily implemented Ubisoft ideas and then sort of, like, threw them into their game?
The thing is, there is – here's – like, I didn't even get to how this is distinct from those games. So instead of picking – all right, so what I expected was actually a little bit more Ubisoft. I thought what I was getting was Romance of the Three Kingdoms 7, 8, 10, or 12. I think 10 or 12, which were you can play as an individual officer in the world, and the world is going to move around you, and you can pledge loyalty to various warlords and kingdoms and like different you know, whoever, dynastic heads, and you would end up being one soldier in their push. Instead, you have four distinct story modes, basically, or story, like, lanes. Yeah, basically. Each kingdom is basically one of the stories. And you go chapter by chapter, and in each chapter, you pick a character to play as. So instead of being one continuous playthrough, you're going to a chapter, you're getting the opening story cutscene, you're going in, you're doing a collection of, like, whatever, three main quests and six side quests or however many side quests you find. And then you're done with that chapter. You see an ending cutscene. You move on to the next one. You pick a new character and you keep going. And so it doesn't have the Ubisoft continuity. You're not tracking, you know, Zhou Yu through his entire arc. You're not following Lu Bu from Rise to Fall, right? Like you're picking a kingdom and going through its story. And to some degree, that's a cool way of telling that story. Past Dynasty Warriors games have done that where you're like, okay, I'm committed to the Wu family for life. You know, obviously, Wu-Tang. Descended from Sun Tzu. Like, there's a whole – oh, it's so good. But the in this, like, it feels so fractured. And the thing that it feels like it should be offering is the feeling of those earlier Romance of the Three Kingdoms games, which end up feeling sort of like Crusader Kings 2. Like, what I want is this game, except it's Mountain Blade or Crusader Kings 2, but also then when instead of having, like, tactical battles, I'm killing 1,000 people on a horse. That's all I want, Rob. And also there's a grappling hook. The grappling hook should feel better. It's a grappling hook. Grappling hook should feel good in video games.
It's not up to your standards?
It's not up to my grappling hook standards. I just hit R1 and climb a building real quick. It's fine.
Okay.
It's fine. It's fine. It's I'm not mad at all.
Not mad.
I'm just disappointed.
Maybe the recent port of the latest Romance of the Three Kingdoms strategy game would make you feel better. Maybe we should play that together.
I don't know.
And like,
it's not the kind that I like. It's fine. 13? Is it 13?
Wow.
It's not. There's odd number ones and even number ones. There are different types of Romance of the Three Kingdoms. I'm not. This isn't.
18 B team? I don't know.
I think you. So actually, the questions are being like, maybe the A team is off making these side games at this point. Maybe they're the ones. Like, you get the Zelda license, you get the Fire Emblem license. You better put a good team on that. Nintendo's involved. So, like, maybe that is where it's at right now. And that would
just
be a weird place.
Yeah, just a theory.
I think that's a fine theory at the very least. Or you know what? Maybe it's the Tecmo side team. Like I don't know. I'm curious what the future of Dynasty Warriors is because it ain't going anywhere. The series is too
space.
It's too big for it to just disappear overnight. But I don't know.
I actually would be really interested. Sorry, I said space, and that's like the pat answer. But I would be super interested in like a sci-fi. Like, how did the clans actually like expand on a
they
planetary
did,
level?
They did one.
They did this already? Oh, crap.
That was in their own sci-fi universe, and I can't remember what the name of it was. Omega Force definitely made one. It had a really funny name.
Whoa.
Not Winback, though. They did make Winback.
I
forget what it was. It was an Xbox. I want to say it was an Xbox like one game that was like in a sci-fi world. I'm not going to find it.
Okay.
The game that this actually reminds me the most of in some ways is Bladestorm, which is another Koei Tecmo game that three people have played. So I'm just going to move on. We're going to move on.
Bladestorm.
I like Bladestorm more. Bladestorm is a better version of Dynasty Warriors 9. There, I said it.
Cool.
Before, I love little visits to Austin's Island of Misfit franchises.
It's a lot. Like, that's the thing that's fucked with me as a person, is, like, all of my favorite franchises are these things that are, like, not particularly well-loved, but either are hyper-popular inside of a niche that is ignored or else are just not very good, honestly, but strike an important and real core with me.
I understand about unloved games, you know, as you know, world's number one praise, Dan. It's fine.
That's true.
It's fine.
That's
Hi,
true.
Rob. I know you're
Hey, look, people keep writing in. The movement is growing. Like, every week I get two or three emails who are like, thank God you guys, like, kept like banging that drum because Prey is how I met my real love, Prey.
Yep.
Wait.
Yep.
Okay. Got it.
It's correct.
Very briefly, because we'll get into this more once more people have played it. I do also just want to shout out the game I'm actually most enjoying right now and that people should start getting excited for, I think, which is Into the Breach, which is the new game by Subset, who made FTL a few years ago, way more than a few years ago now.
Yeah, it was like 2014 or something.
It was
like
before
that, right?
That even.
FTL might have been like
2013?
2012. I think 2010 it came to that. It came to OnLive in 2010 or 2011. If you all remember OnLive, that game streaming service, they had it as an exclusive, like a beta build of it. But yeah, that released in 2012, which was five and a half years ago, let's say. Into the Breach is a tactical run-based mecha kaiju RPG, tactical RPG, in the vein of, obviously, Pacific Rim is like a really good touchstone here, where you have a squad of three mechs, and there is an island, and you go to the island. The island has some sectors on it, and you go to defend those little sectors.
Cool.
And so each sector is a procedurally generated map, single screen map. You're not exploring a lot of space. You just see the map right away. Your mechs drop down. Little people in the buildings go like, oh, the Riftwalkers are here to save us, or whatever squad name you have. And you're given five turns to survive. If a building gets hit, your life bar goes down. You have like a power grid. Your individual mechs all have life bars too, and they have pilots. And if the pilots live, rad, they get XP and they can level up and unlock new abilities. If they die, they're replaced by AI that can't level up anymore.
Hmm.
And a lot of this game opens up as you unlock more mechs, because what you learn is they have status abilities and power, movement powers, where it's a lot of like – it's very cinematic and choreographed feeling in terms of what its combat is. So like – one of my favorite mechs right now has an ability to do like an electricity whip that does damage to anything it is connected to what you're whipping, right? And it has an upgrade that lets it pass that electricity through buildings without harming them. So there is a moment where it's like six enemies on screen. My other mechs do things like move the other enemies around. Like they like have the ability to like do knockback damage basically. And so there was a moment where I knocked back two enemies – across the two different sides of the map. So they were next to buildings, and my dude with the whip whipped an enemy near him, and the electricity like surged through the entire map and hit the enemies on the other side. And it's just this incredible moment of like tactical storytelling that I haven't seen in the game since, like, for me, since Invisible Inc. In terms of like, how the fuck do I get out of this situation? Rob,
an important question there.
Yeah.
Just in terms of like the sort of trade-offs you made in that interaction.
Yeah.
I thought you said you didn't want the buildings to get hit.
Yeah, I had an upgrade.
But there
so
you knocked them.
No, so I knocked them next to the building. You can also knock them into a building to do damage, right? Like, you can do knockback damage into a building, which does damage. The power grid loses a point. The power grid is like the hole in FTL. Like,
okay,
that's the thing
okay.
you want to like keep fixed up and keep the defenses up on it. I don't want to talk again too much about it. I'm going to talk. We'll talk more about it in the future because I think it's like genuinely. It's the first time that I've had that moment that made me love Invisible Inc. so much a few years ago, which is just like, fuck, there's no way out of this. I can't win this one. And then you like see something and it clicks in your head that like, oh, I can use this to pull this and I can create this other effect. Very chess-like, very chess puzzle in that way, but like also giant robots and giant bugs that you fight.
With the Austin Rift Walkers.
With the Austin Rift Walkers. That's the default name for the first squad is the Rift Walkers. I didn't.
Is the spectacle good? Like, does it feel like weighty and good like Kaiju Mecha or?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like it's sprite-based art. It looks like FTL. Ooh. It's like a cute like vibe. I like it. I like it a whole bunch. I think that like it communicates. You know what it communicates? It doesn't necessarily communicate like. Size because it's just like an isometric tactical RPG, but it does communicate like momentum really well. Like you get a good thing like a dash punch with one of your mechs and like they just like sprint across the entire thing super quick and do like a good piece of knockback damage that sends them into a mountain or something, sends a giant ant or a giant like slug creature into a mountain. It feels good. That stuff works really well. And a lot of the stuff around the edges in terms of the fiction and the character design is all really dope. So look forward to that later this month. That's like the 27th, I want to say, got dated for. So
that's the end of the month.
Yeah, it's the end of the month. So look forward to that. That's the only other thing I've really been playing besides disappointing Dynasty Warriors 9.
Oh, I have a shout out.
Sure,
as
please.
Well.
Yes.
I played a game that I really liked. And it's from somebody who has made a bunch of games that I've really liked. Sean Hantani. He has made Anodyne,
I love Anodyne.
Love, love, love. And also Even the Ocean, which I also super loved. Those were with Joni Kitaka. And this is one of his – it's not totally solo. But he made like an almost solo project. A 3D game. Has very like PlayStation 1 era graphics. Very, very abstract. Very, very pretty, I think. And it's a game actually about – I'll just tell you the premise. It's about a Japanese-American dude – who finds out his father is dying, his estranged father is dying. Huh. And it's sort of this, like, sci-fi, but also semi-supernatural premise where he gets to kind of go inside his head and live through some of his memories.
Oh, interesting.
Some of his sort of dying memories. And it goes into a lot of aspects of sort of Asian-American identity. It goes very, very hard.
You've written about
this
for the site, right?
Yeah, I wrote a piece about it, interviewing Sean. It's just a really thoughtful, really beautiful game.
I love the way this looks.
I do too.
It has like such a cool, like we haven't seen a ton of things in this like PS1 retro style yet. It has felt like we've been on the brink of those for the last, few years basically.
Yeah, there's been like a couple like Silent Hill, there's been a couple of horror games that have like tried to pick up on like the Silent Hill 1 aesthetic, but like we haven't. It feels like the PlayStation 1. In the next couple of years, we're going to be hitting an era in which there were a lot of people that grew up on the PlayStation as their like primary piece of nostalgia, as opposed to, I think, not that like pixel art games will go away, like the simplicity, like there's a lot of reason for people to use pixel art, but I wonder if soon we're going to start seeing like more people pick up the PlayStation 1 aesthetic because that's like, hey, that's actually my nostalgia is like early, like, polygonal 3D games, which I am into that. Like I started on the SNES, but PlayStation 1 was definitely a huge part of my growing up. And so like, yo, give me some more PlayStation 1 style games.
I think really special in this design that I think all our Asia's hits, which is Sprites and 2D based art can obviously become very abstract, and you can do really experimental stuff with it. I'm not saying that you can't, but by to do that in that space, it feels like, and this is just from my observation, what you're doing is going out of your way to draw art, to create art that looks abstract and strange.
Yes.
But that the prominent form, if you're trying to make games that look like games that came out on the SNES or the Sega Genesis or the TurboGrafx, there is a certain sort of absurdity to them that comes just from like video games and like jumping on enemy heads and all that shit. That's all.
It's harder to take it seriously if you want to tell more grounded or emotional story. Like there are some games that get away with it, but like they got to do a lot of heavy lifting.
But the PS1 stuff is like. PS1 games just look wild. Like, if you go look at what PS1 games looked like randomly, you will find stuff that looks like experimental art, just that it was just regular games. That was just like, oh, this is an action shooter, but it looks wild because there wasn't a lot of, like, draw distance, because there was a heavy use of fog because of that fog distance.
The language wasn't set at that
point. Right, exactly.
Which is amazing.
And so, like, a game like this, one of the things that's interesting is, like, yes, I can tell that this is like an experimental or kind of has a sort of avant-garde approach to storytelling in our space.
Game,
it's a very personal game. It's trying to do things that put expression, visual expression at a premium in terms of like its design and stuff like that. But also, it does just look like this could be an RPG. Squaresoft could have put this out in terms of its like visual design. Or like it could have been in the Shin Megami Tensei series
main inspirations, actually.
There you go.
Yeah, Nocturne, I think, actually.
Right. Nocturne is a great example. It's a PS2 game, but like I think still
had that very incredible like, the lighting and just sort of how really sort of theatrical and stagey a lot of things.
Exactly. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in seeing like PS1 style throwback graphics is like, hey, a lot of those games just look weird and in a way that just trying to replicate the look will allow game developers to enter this kind of interesting kooky space.
Sean had a lot of really cool thoughts about that as well, and he's sort of a musician by trade and a designer by trade, and he's not like a 3D artist, and he said like, look, these are simple tools that allow me to really get evocative, and I also just really like the way this looks. I think it's very warm, and it's something I've sort of struggled with. I'm making like a tiny little thing that's supposed to be a little bit of a serious story, but doing a walk animation in sprite art is like the worst thing to try to make it look serious. So I completely, just even in my own little tiny experimentations, am seeing exactly what he was talking about with this by making sort of your player avatar is just sort of this little globe with petals, right? And all the people that you see are very simple sort of 3D sort of figures. There's no talking animation or anything like that, but you get a real sense of things. And he also said something along the lines of, I'm paraphrasing, but people can actually sort of use their imagination to fill in the blanks, and that's way more evocative than, oh, I made this beautiful, perfectly rendered 3D face or something.
Totally.
So that was really cool. All Our Asias, it's really rad. It's actually a free game. People want to try it out. And if you really dig it, there's like a $5 like fan pack. You get the soundtrack and this actually really cool book that goes into the making of the game and how
awesome.
It came about, all of his art choices.
Right.
It even has like all the Ableton like tables
for
every song.
That's really cool.
Really cool. So.
That's really cool. Awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty rad.
Is there like an itch.io link? Is that the kind
there's itch.io and Steam actually.
Awesome.
I got an itch.io.
All Our Asias, multiple Asias.
Yes.
Because that is how the world is.
Yep.
That's accurate.
Yes.
Cool. Awesome. And again, you wrote about that on the site, waypoint.vice.com. Let's dip into the question bucket real quick and maybe hit a couple of these real quick, and then we will be out for the day. Let us start with this one from Sean. Hey, Waypointers, if you have a question, gaming@vice.com, obviously, you can send your question, use the subject question. Because of your coverage, Sean says, I've recently picked up XCOM 2. War of the Chosen, and found myself having a great time with it. I was particularly impressed by The Lost, XCOM 2's ability to translate the feeling of being overwhelmed by a horde of zombies and being dependent on your aim and the amount of bullets left in your gun into the turn-based tactical format of the XCOM series was surprising and well thought out. My question is, can you think of any other examples of games that managed to successfully translate a feeling or style, be it from games or other media, into a gameplay format you wouldn't expect would be capable of it? Like,
I feel like All Our Asias does that.
You just did this. Yeah, we just talked about All Our
Asias. It feels like super pertinent, actually, because it does feel very warm, and it feels like exploring a very abstract space. So it does
that sort of translation into games that you wouldn't traditionally think of.
The idea of like a mind in a dream world. It actually feels like that. It evokes that in a very, very interesting and cool.
Awesome. My favorite weird example of this, welcome to the Austin Walker niche game space, is Evil Zone, the PS1 fighting game that presents all of its characters as different anime heroes. It's like, in terms of anime tropes, right? So it's like, oh, this is like the Power Ranger stand-in. This is the, like, the fighting action hero stand-in. Blah, blah, blah. You know, this is the magical girl show, like, character, basically. But each of them in the single-player story mode, each fight was broken up by episode bumpers, as if they were, like, going to commercial breaks, and then, like, an intro and an outro that is, like, from a fake anime. And so it takes what is like a really boring, straightforward, bad fighting game, mediocre. I like that game a lot. And dresses it up.
It's bad. I like it's it a mediocre. Lot. I like that game a lot.
Good. I don't think the design, I don't think the combat.
It's in my top 10. It might be my favorite game of all 20. Time.
It's in why my
don't
top,
people
it's,
it, think piece? Why don't more people play
I don't
Evil
think
Zone?
Else should play it unless you're me, in which case you should play it more often to remember why you like video games to begin with, right? Like that's the thing with weird games like this for me is like I go through the year and have like an okay time with 95% of games and often get to December and I'm like, why the fuck do I even have a top 10 list? And the answer is because like every now and then you get to play an Evil Zone or a Dragon's Dogma. So look up Evil Zone. That is my answer here, which is like I played a lot of fighting games. None of them had communicated the bullshit feeling of anime to me. Evil Zone did it. Rob, Patrick, a game in which any games in which they translate a genre or style into a gameplay format as a genre that you wouldn't think of that they could do it.
The question is like about something so ineffable that I'm having a hard, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
I'm having to recall a feeling of surprise.
Yeah.
That something that I can't even fully articulate was then translated into a medium, and I'm racking my brain and failing.
I mean, I don't know. Does this answer the question to say, I think there were a lot, this was, I mean, whatever. The way I dunk on anime, like, hopefully people obviously realize, like, a lot of that is just, like, a joke.
But
yes. But, so it's like, I wonder, like, last year, I think a lot of people got into Nier Automata and really liked the story, probably not realizing that calling that game anime is both funny and also like true, like of how many like that it's very like that had a very anime style of storytelling that people found like very touching and evocative and emotional. And so like it's very difficult to hold two thoughts in your head at one time, which is like anime is bad, but also Nier Automata is good. Actually, it's more just that like a lot of things, a lot of anime is bad, and then there are the stuff if you like that is good. So I wonder if. I wonder if like that gets at a different way, which is like a form of storytelling that like a lot of people would largely be dismissive of. That, but if given the right vehicle, you can actually realize some of the things that you would like about it. If maybe you dropped a little bit of like your presumption about what it is or isn't.
My other big answer here is Starbound, which is a 2D game like Terraria, where your Terraria is like a 2D version of Minecraft. You're digging, you're building things, you're collecting materials, you're finding ore. But then also Terraria and Starbound both have like fighting in them in a big way where you're crafting cool weapons and special items and stuff. And the thing that Starbound does, the feeling that it promotes that I never thought that this genre, this kind of like 2D exploration and crafting game, like the kind of always in previous games, was like, oh, you're on this one planet, is like space hopping space opera with like all of these different like sci-fi space alien cultures, and you're piecing together a bigger picture about what happened in the universe as you go from place to place. Like there aren't that many worlds that you or like species or cultures, and yet it feels like a big universe even though you're seeing everything from this 2D plane. So
I dig that.
Cool. That is one that I wish I had more time to go back to. I think there's one more, but we're going to save this for next time, I think, because I think it's a little meatier than can fit in a single.
We had a lot of meat on this podcast, Bones.
Very meaty, meaty bones. Do they have any meaty bones at your mini golf place?
Oh, yeah.
What? Why? I mean, you don't.
No, it's. A meaty bone is what I need to start grinding it's Monster Hunter in order to get that level 3, I think level 4 ice hammer. Yo, the ice hammer looks
un-fucking
believable in that game. It's got huge ass spikes coming out of it. Take that, Diablos.
Does Diablos hate ice?
No, I think that would be actually Anjanath, and Anjanath would be
He's a fire. He's a fire. What's Diablo say? I'm going to get this chart up. We should go.
Haven't you already killed all these things?
70 times.
Yeah, but you got to fight them a bunch of times. You got to fight them a bunch of...
Canonically.
Do they get harder each time?
They do get harder once.
They get harder once. There's low rank and high rank. So basically, like, there's a low rank version of the game, which is basically, like, onboarding you, and then high rank is, like, they get a lot more aggressive and push you around, and they change, like, their behaviors. And
when is G rank coming? That's what the internet wants to know. There's a higher rank in the previous Monster Hunter games called G rank. You have to be a true G to play G rank.
Monster Hunter G.
And I want to know if it's coming.
A true gamer?
The gamer rank? Yeah. If you ever listen to old hip-hop and someone talks about real Gs, they're talking about gamers, FYI.
Yep.
G-Unit is gamer unit. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yo, Fitty, hit that big-ass ramp, as Lloyd Banks would say. All right, that's going to do it for us today. I'm Austin Walker. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Austin_Walker. Danielle, where can people find you?
At Danielle or I, or also at Shipwrecked Minigolf.
At Shipwrecked Minigolf. Find Danielle.
The new manager over at the Shipwrecked Minigolf.
I'm auditioning EMT. For the next post. I'm going to be the next character.
Look, everyone's got to have a... Everyone has to have a plan B.
Absolutely.
You know?
In case this doesn't work out.
I get it. Listen,
you know what I mean?
No harm, no foul. Rob Zachney, where can people find you?
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.
No B plan for you? No backup plan? No... Okay.
My name is my name.
Got you. I got you. Good. Good on you. Did you finish that fucking series yet, Rob? The Wire? Oh, wow, he can't hear
He can't hear.
Oh, weird.
Patrick? Connection's getting pretty spotty. Sorry, guys.
Okay, good. Patrick?
You can follow me at Patrick.
Great. As always, you can follow the whole show, everybody here, twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice. Follow everything we do at waypoint.vice.com. Shout outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. And as always, come talk to us, discourse.zone for our forums. It's going to do it for us this week. Danielle, what do we say to him?
Be good and be good at it.
Peace.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.